Welcome, everyone, to the Compliance Week podcast. I'm Aaron Nicodemus, staff writer at Compliance Week, and I'll be your host today. I'm chatting with Andrew McBride, who until very recently was the chief risk officer and chief compliance officer at Albemarle Corp., a chemical manufacturer based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andrew will be speaking on a panel at Compliance Week National, which will be held from April 2nd to the 4th at the Westin in Washington, D.C. Andrew, welcome to the Compliance Week podcast.
Thanks, Aaron. Pleasure to be here.
So talk to me a little bit about your professional background. How did you come to Albemarle?
Yeah, it's quite a long and winding road, but I'll try and give the Cliff Notes version of it. So I started out in private practice at a law firm, Linklaters, in the UK. There I started really specializing in competition and antitrust law, which was very much focused on cartels, merger control, and advising on distribution arrangements. And I think it was through that I started to get an appreciation and love for data analytics as part of econometric studies. Continued the antitrust role into BP, both in London and Chicago, before heading up the global antitrust team at BHP. And it was really at BHP that over the years I took on broader responsibility beyond antitrust into areas of anti-corruption and elsewhere. And what really struck me was that kind of sitting at top of multiple areas of compliance was just how much similarity there was in terms of the approach between different areas of compliance. But SMEs tended to focus on their own swim lanes. That really got me thinking at that point about smart governance, about how we can kind of focus on user-centric governance design rather than, you know, what's good for the SME. The other thing that really struck me at BHP, but then moving to Albemarle, was the importance of functional engagement. And so I joined Albemarle back in 2018 after a short break for getting a green card and moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. And I think we're going to get into kind of like life at Albemarle in a moment.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, that I think it's appropriate to mention that you recently left the company. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So I spent 6 years at Albemarle. It was an absolute pleasure. In fact, last Friday was my last day. Really proud of the team that I built at Albemarle. Over the years, we've built the team up to 13 compliance professionals of 11 different nationalities and a broad range of backgrounds. And so the company is in great hands, and I'll be supporting it from afar. It does mean that the views expressed on the podcast and also Compliance Week are my own personal views, not those of the company. So I won't be sharing any company confidential information either.
Right. Well, we wouldn't expect you to be sharing confidential information.
Exactly.
So you joined Albemarle, like you said, in 2018, several days before its first self-report meeting with the Department of Justice and the SEC regarding violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The investigation culminated in a non-prosecution agreement with the DOJ and similar resolution with the SEC. Can you give me a recap on the outcome of the Albemarle NPA?
Yeah, and I should say that fortunately the general counsel, the former general counsel and the former CEO and the board all let me know before I took on the role what I was getting myself in for. So I knew about the intended self-report, but you're right, I started several days before that first meeting. And so for those of listeners who are not aware, so the Albemarle investigation, we self-reported conduct and suspected violation of the FCPA back in 2018. The conduct related to activities of sales agents and several employees in our company's refining solutions business unit. That business unit makes catalysts that either help refineries operate more efficiently or also take out nasty stuff from the processing of crude oil. And it was very common in the industry for the use of sales agents. And as the investigation kind of carried on, and as is public, the countries of focus for the Department of Justice were Vietnam, Indonesia, and India. The SEC also China and the UAE, with an obvious focus on controls. And this investigation kind of culminated at the end of September of last year with the MPA, which was the first MPA in several years with the DOJ, and a similar order with the SEC. A penalty of $218 million was paid, but that represented a 45% reduction off the bottom line of the U.S. sentencing guidelines. That 45% reduction was a function of cooperation, including our self-report, the remediation measures that we put in place, which I think we'll talk about in a bit more detail. And then also, I think something that's got interest in the community is that we got credit for bonuses that were withheld. So it was a holdback rather than a clawback, but the value of those bonuses was effectively credited to our penalty.
What are some high-level takeaways that you have from that experience, including some of the remediation that you took to address the issue?
So I think that there are several kind of key takeaways, some things that are fairly unique about that have been cited by commentators for the Albemarle resolution. So the Department of Justice called out that the remediation started pretty much straight away from the moment that the internal investigation commenced. So when I arrived at the company, some time after the commencement of the internal investigation, the investigation was well underway. The remediation was well underway. And so within several days of arriving, I was presented with a very detailed report of the root cause analysis for the investigation, and then also kind of an overview of some of the remediation that was already underway, which we'll talk about. And then effectively, I assumed responsibility for that remediation. The other perhaps unique thing was the transformation of our go-to-market strategy. So as called out by the DOJ, we eliminated all sales agents in the company. And then within our refining solutions business, we also eliminated all other types of sales intermediaries, such as distributors or resellers. And I'll be honest, I can take no credit for that executive decision for changing that go-to-market strategy. That was a decision taken at the highest level of the company. I mean, you really have to have that level of support to make such a huge transformation of the way in which you're going to market. And as I think listeners will appreciate, I mean, to do that, I mean, just requires wholesale transformation. It requires you to set up new legal entities in countries. It requires a new way of marketing, developing those relationships with end customers. And so it was very much a multifunctional effort supporting the global business units to change the way in which they were engaging with customers.
Right.
Thirdly, the use of data analytics. So, I think continuing that theme from my antitrust days, just had a real fascination for data analytics. And, fairly early on in my time at Albemarle, I started to get introduced to the likes of Tableau and Microsoft Power BI, and it really opened my mind as to what we could do. I got introduced to Matt Galvin, who was at the AB InBev at that time. And again, he was really shining a light on kind of like what in-house compliance officers could do. And so I went back to the company and I recommended that we take on some additional data analytics resource. We recruited a data scientist for a period of time to really help get the infrastructure in place. And that data analytics served a number of purposes. So it supported our direct remediation efforts with our transformation of our marketing strategy. It also supported transaction testing, whether on the sales or on the vendor side. And it also just was very, very helpful in supporting the broader execution of our ethics and compliance program. And sometimes I hear people kind of talk about compliance data analytics, whereas I prefer to kind of describe it as any kind of analytics that can help our compliance program be more effective. So one example of that, we launched our new code of conduct in 2019. And in order to maximize the effectiveness of our launch, I wanted to find out what would be the optimal day to launch. And so working with our HR team, we ran analytics to find out the day towards the end of August when the least amount of people in the company would be on vacation. That's not compliance analytics, that's just basic data analytics, but was hugely effective in figuring out kind of when was the optimal time to launch our code of conduct. And it was the same for our kind of any of our ethics and compliance communications. We, through our analytics of how people were using our company intranet site, I knew that Tuesday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern time was the optimal time to kind of push things out. So I would also add that we use data analytics to help support other functions as well. So we became almost thought leaders internally around data analytics. We would support functions like procurement in using that analytics to support their own programs. And then also it helped us kind of embed those ethics and compliance controls into their functional processes. And then finally, I think, you know, that spirit of continuous improvement. So just being driven by a sense of humility, of let's try something. If it doesn't work, fail fast and move on to the next thing. And, you know, we really, you know, during our discussions with the DOJ, kind of like that sense of humility was really important, of flagging what was working, what was not working, and how we were kind of like improving.
It's funny that you mention audience engagement and knowing your audience. That's something us in journalism have to be very intimately familiar with. But I'm assuming that you were also checking to see that they were getting the message, that they were reading it, that they were reacting to it, right?
That's right. So certainly on our, we developed an interactive code of conduct, which helped us track at an aggregate level how employees were using the code, which could help drive behaviors. It could drive how we engage with different employee populations in countries. It also helped us figure out which parts of the code were getting more traction, which were getting less traction, which would then trigger improvements to some of the areas of the code. And so, you know, data is one thing. It's how you react to the data, which is so critically important.
I saw you on a recent podcast with Tom Fox, and you were talking about how compliance can also use data analytics to sort of press your advantage with other parts of your company. And I'm just wondering, based on your experience, can you provide some personal views on building effective compliance programs?
I think that spirit of innovation and continuous improvement, and data is so critical to that. So if you look at each and every element of your program, data analytics does not simply equate to training metrics or transaction testing. It's so much, it can be so much more than that. And so, you know, a couple of areas where, you know, driving that point about the effectiveness of the compliance program. So on the governance side, I mean, clearly it's so important to have kind of like your key anchor policies, like your anti-corruption policy, your antitrust policy. But I would say that I spend as much, if not more time collaborating with the functions on their respective global policies, procurement, sales, some policies within finance. Because if you think about it, an employee, they wake up one morning and they want some support or guidance. Are they going to pick up an anti-corruption policy, or are they going to pick up their sales policy if they're a sales employee? More likely to pick up the sales policy. And so really important that we embedded those ethics and compliance requirements into our code of conduct. So we organize our code by reference to employee activity, not area of law. So we would have an engaging with customers section in the code that then flowed through to a global sales policy. And then any pre-approval requirements embedded in that sales policy were articulated in supporting procedures. And so it allowed for that kind of governance waterfall that flowed directly from the employee activity. And then accessibility. So from a governance point of view, just making sure that if we were asking employees to do things, that we needed to make sure that they could get access to the code or to the policies as easy as possible. So that's the genesis for the development of the interactive e-code. And we were getting great engagement because of it being a e-code that was available on laptop, on mobile devices, but also because of the way it was structured according to employee activity. In terms of the testing of effectiveness, one thing which, you know, really I found quite interesting is if you look at the Albemarle MPA, or indeed any MPA, DPA in the appendices, if you see the attachments, you've got attachment C, which describes kind of like the expectations of the compliance program that people subject to an MPA or DPA are beholden to. And then you've got attachment D, which talks about the annual testing plan that those companies are expected to put together and to implement. And you know, that concept of testing, you know, it goes beyond, I think, kind of like that audit. It's really about taking a fresh look on a periodic basis at each element of your program and thinking about, is it working? How can we make it better? What do we need to do to make it better? And so, you know, we would kind of look at each element of our program and just be thinking about how can we use data to validate that this particular aspect of our program is working. And sometimes it wasn't data. Sometimes it was more than that. And in fact, I think there's a lot to be learned from sustainability auditors in this area. So Albemarle is the world's largest lithium company. And, you know, with that comes some pretty significant sustainability responsibilities to its customers, particularly in the car manufacturing sector. And so we were publicly committing ourselves to a very strict mining sustainability standard called the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance. And through that process, you have the sustainability auditors come in, and they are really testing kind of that your program is working in all aspects of sustainability. So from a community affairs perspective, the way in which, for example, we engage with the local indigenous community in the Salar de Atacama in Chile, it wasn't just about having a community relations policy. It was about how we communicated it. So, and that wasn't just, you know, emails out to people. That was actually going out to members of the local community, and the auditors requiring evidence, like photographic evidence of us engaging with the community, of the posters being situated around the community, encouraging people to speak up. That's not data analytics, but it's other types of evidence that was needed to demonstrate that our program was being implemented, it was working in the appropriate way. So I think a combination of those different ways in which to demonstrate the effectiveness of the program are really critical.
You mentioned, you know, audits, and you mentioned this, basically proving that what you're doing is being effective. Those are, I think, messages that anyone listening to this podcast should be able to take away some lessons from. Later on in your time at Albemarle, your role was expanded to Chief Risk Officer. Do you see that as part of a growing trend?
I've certainly seen a number of other Chief Compliance Officers make that transition into Chief Risk Officer. And so I think there's definitely something there, whether it's just on the risk path or to sustainability. I mean, if we think about third-party risk as an example, you know, we all start, obviously, sanctions and FCPA have always kind of like been there. But then you started adding on other areas of compliance associated with third-party risk, like data privacy, data security. And then there was conflict minerals and more broader modern slavery. And when you're getting into kind of like modern slavery, you're getting into human rights-related sanctions, then it's not too far away from geopolitical risk. And certainly at Albemarle, there was that recognition that particularly for a company that was operating in the battery material space, geopolitical risk was a really kind of important concept, you know, relationships between the US, China, and other countries. And so that recognition of, you know, particularly where you're making investments in higher risk countries around the world and needing to kind of adopt frameworks to identify and manage those risks, chief compliance officers are well placed to be able to make that step up. They're very good at doing risk assessment, really good at the governance, and have a familiarity with the supporting systems. And so I do think that is a journey that many compliance officers could be taking.
Well, I'm almost ready to wrap up this podcast, and I want to thank you for participating. Tell me a little bit, are you able to share any of your future plans?
Yeah, so for me, I mean, it's still early days, but what I'm really kind of interested about is, you know, what we were just talking about, what's really going on at the margins, right? So How do we ensure that different areas of compliance kind of are more integrated? How do we ensure that that relationship between compliance and sustainability and risk are kind of like mapped out? And so really doing a lot of thinking about that. I mean, the time at Albemarle was really an eye-opener to kind of like the place of compliance within the broader kind of ecosystem. And then obviously the use of data analytics to support that, how compliance engages with other functions. And so, you know, right now doing a lot of thinking about that and, you know, just engaging with a lot of compliance peers just to understand kind of what's going on. And yeah, we'll see what the future holds.
Well, good luck. I hope that you find a new path that is rewarding as the one that you just followed at Albemarle. So just a reminder, everyone, Andrew will be speaking at Compliance Week National, which will be held April 2nd to 4th at the Westin in Washington, D.C. He'll expound on some of the topics we've talked about today and provide more insight into his time at Albemarle. Andrew, thanks again for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Aaron.